Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Monday, March 11, 2024. President Joe Biden releases his fiscal year 2025 budget proposal, $7.3 trillion, $400 billion more than his fiscal year 2024 budget. With increases in federal benefit programs, affordable housing, student debt cancellation, and more, and tax increases on wealthy individuals and corporations, and he says that it will reduce the federal budget deficit by $3 trillion over a decade. Coming up, we hear from the president, the OMB director, the deputy defense secretary, the transportation secretary, and the NASA administrator. And Republican Congressman Jody Arrington, the budget committee chair, talks about the House Republican fiscal year 2025 budget resolution that was approved last week. Former President Donald Trump, Republican presidential candidate, is asked on CNBC about ways to reduce entitlement spending, such as Social Security and Medicare, and according to some news reports, he floated the idea of cutting them. The Trump campaign says that the candidate was talking about cutting waste. We'll play the clip. You can decide. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marsha Fudge resigning after 3 years in that job. The FBI Director Christopher Wray has asked about a bill the House will be voting on this week that could ban TikTok in the United States. CIA Director William Burns gives his assessment of Russia's war in Ukraine. Both of those figures were at a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing. And the State Department spokesperson on the gang violence in Haiti after the U.S. evacuates non-essential embassy staff and shores up embassy security over the weekend. Story from Axios: President Biden is proposing a $7.3 trillion fiscal year 2025 budget that would offset spending on his key domestic priorities, including tax credits for families and new money for housing, by increasing taxes on corporations and the rich. Biden is using his budget to fill out the fine print of the campaign promises he has been making for months and to press Congress to provide funding for Ukraine, Israel, and border security. My budget also makes key investments in child care and education so every child in America can have the strong start they need to thrive, Biden said in a statement. He went on, for too many hardworking families, it costs too much to find a good home, so we're working to lower costs and boost supply for housing nationwide. Like all budgets, this one has little chance of becoming law, writes Axios, but it allows the Biden administration to clearly articulate its plans and priorities for a second term. The director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, Shalanda Young, held a virtual news conference.
When we speak about the budget continuing lowering costs for families, what do we mean? The president has made lowering costs for hardworking families his top domestic priority. Under his leadership, we've seen significant progress. Inflation has come down about two-thirds. But families need a little bit of breathing room, and that's why the budget includes proposals to bring down the costs of everyday necessities. It lowers healthcare costs, drug costs, and expands access to prescription drugs. It cuts taxes for families with children and American workers and lowers childcare costs for hardworking families. It increases affordable housing supply to reduce housing costs, expands access to home ownership and affordable rent, reduces down payments for first-time and first-generation home buyers with a new mortgage relief credit, and it reduces the cost of college and lifts the burden of student debt. Second, the budget invests in America and the American people to grow the economy from the middle out and the bottom up. The budget invests in all of America to make sure we leave no one behind. It does this by expanding and protecting access to healthcare, supporting America's workforce and boosting manufacturing, confronting the climate crisis and spurring clean energy innovation, providing national paid leave, advancing cancer research, making our community safer, and more. Third, the budget reduces the deficit by about $3 trillion by making our tax code fair. Congressional Republicans want to increase the deficit by trillions of dollars, including by attempting to repeal the parts of the Inflation Reduction Act that take on special interests, like Big Pharma, like going after wealthy tax cheats, all while supporting giveaways to big corporations and the highest income Americans at the expense of America's seniors. In contrast, this president and his budget raises taxes on large corporations, cracks down on corporate profit shifting, ensuring that billionaires pay a minimum 25% rate, and cuts taxes for tens of millions of low and middle income families. The budget also cuts wasteful spending on special interests and cracks down on fraud. President Biden will fight to stop Republican plans to add trillions to the deficit with giveaways to big pharma and tax cuts skewed to big corporations and the wealthy, while ensuring people under $400,000 will not pay a single more in taxes. Fourth, the budget protects and strengthens Social Security and Medicare. Social Security and Medicare are more than government programs. They're a promise, a rock-solid guarantee that generations of Americans have counted on, that after a life of hard work, you will be able to retire with dignity and security. The budget honors the president's ironclad commitment to reject Republican efforts to cut both programs and embraces reforms that will protect and strengthen these programs.
Shalanda Young is the White House Budget Director, Director of the Office of Management and Budget, in a virtual briefing as the president releases his proposed fiscal year 2025 budget today. Speaker Mike Johnson, Republican from Louisiana, putting out a joint statement with other members of the House Republican leadership that reads, "The price tag of President Biden's proposed budget is yet another glaring reminder of this administration's insatiable appetite for reckless spending and the Democrats' disregard for fiscal responsibility. Biden's budget doesn't hit the mark. It's a roadmap to accelerate America's decline." The House budget plan, they go on, for the next fiscal year, preceding the president's proposal, reflects the values of hardworking Americans who know that in tough economic times, fiscal discipline is non-negotiable. The House Budget Committee Chair Jody Arrington, Republican from Texas, talked about the House Republican plan at the budget resolution markup on March 7th.
"This fiscal framework will balance the budget in 10 years by reducing deficit spending by a little over $14 trillion and reducing the debt to GDP by 40 points. We achieve these savings without cutting Medicare, Social Security, and veterans' benefits. Instead, we propose our recently passed bipartisan fiscal commission to find consensus solutions to strengthening and saving these important safety net programs while addressing our $120 trillion long-term unfunded liability. Here's our plan. First, we right-size the bloated bureaucracy that's grown 40% since COVID, hundreds of billions of dollars. The FRA was a good step, but there are hundreds of billions of dollars in unnecessary and wasteful spending in that part of our budget. Next, we reverse President Biden's spending spree, student loan bailouts, hundreds of billions of dollars, expanding welfare without work, and then many of the provisions of the IRA, including 87,000 IRS agents, green corporate energy tax subsidies, expanded Obamacare to people making over $500,000, unnecessary, wasteful, and not the mission of the federal government. Third, we rein in runaway mandatory spending through entitlement reforms. These are the debt drivers. Mandatory spending makes up 73% of our budget today. In 10 years, CBO says it'll be 80%, but it represents 90% of our growth in spending. We must address it if we want to reverse the curse of a debt crisis. Fourth, we root out rampant waste and fraudulent spending. According to GAO, that's over $2 trillion. Fifth, we reignite growth and prosperity by locking in lower taxes, by rolling back the barrage of expensive and unnecessary regulations, unleash American energy independence, and get back to America First trade policies. Look, we all know our current fiscal trajectory is unsustainable and the catastrophic and irreparable harm that will come to this country if we fail to act."
Congressman Jody Arrington, Republican from Texas, chair of the House Budget Committee, last Thursday, March 7th, at the fiscal year 2025 budget resolution markup. And today, President Biden released his fiscal year 2025 budget proposal. On the House GOP plan to balance the federal budget in 10 years, Associated Press writes, "Their measure would depend on rosy economic forecasts and sharp spending cuts, reducing $8.7 trillion in Medicare and Medicaid expenditures, and that President Biden has pledged to stop any cuts to Medicare." On the president's proposal out today, this from Federal News Network, the Biden administration is asking Congress for $1.63 trillion for defense and non-defense discretionary accounts in 2025, which is $11 million or 0.7% over the enacted levels for 2024. 2023. The new spending proposal breaks down to $895 billion for defense spending and $734 billion for non-defense spending, 4.3% above and 3.4% below the enacted 2023 spending levels, respectively. That was from Federal News Network. The Pentagon held a briefing today about their version of the president's proposal for fiscal year 2025. Here's the Deputy Defense Secretary, Kathleen Hicks.
This year's FY25 defense budget request at $849.8 billion would build on and advance generational military investments we've put in motion over the past several years. For the fourth year in a row, our budget furthers our goals to defend the nation, take care of our people, and succeed through teamwork. Unlike our prior budgets, however, the FY25 request is capped by the Fiscal Responsibility Act. Because of these statutory caps and as good stewards of taxpayer dollars, we made smart, responsible choices to work within those limits. The result is a strong focus on executability and necessary emphasis on near-term readiness and people investments. But to be clear, we must grow the defense budget in the out years of our future years defense program if we want to achieve the goals of the National Defense Strategy, especially in the face of rapid modernization by the PRC. Now, budgets are statements of priorities, and we used a rigorous process guided by our strategy to arrive at the resourcing determinations we've made. That process included close dialogue and collaboration among senior DoD leaders representing every defense component, military service, and combatant command. Together, we remained singularly focused on identifying the programs and plans that best meet the demands of today's warfighters and their families while making smart investments in the future. That's vital because since day one, Secretary Austin and I have emphasized the urgency to innovate. One key focus in innovation is overcoming institutional challenges that inhibit our ability to accelerate delivery of critical capabilities to the warfighter at speed and scale. That's the goal of Replicator, including its first focus area on all-domain attritable autonomous systems and many similar initiatives the department has underway. So even under the FY25 cap, we continue to make investments in basic research, advanced technology, experimentation, artificial intelligence, and cyber and space capabilities. And we are committed to robust procurement, sending strong market signals to industry.
The Deputy Defense Secretary Kathleen Hicks in a Pentagon news conference on the release of President Biden's fiscal year 2025 budget request. A story about the overall budget request from Business Insider reads that Biden's budget for fiscal year 2025 seeks to restore the expanded child tax credit first enacted under the American Rescue Plan. That legislation meant parents received a beefed-up refundable credit partially through monthly checks, ultimately halving child poverty. The budget also seeks to lower child care costs so that families earning less than $200,000 would pay $10 or less per day of care and to enact a national paid family and medical leave program. Other key elements of Biden's budget request include boosted funding for the Federal Student Aid Office to facilitate the repayment transition for millions of student loan borrowers, further investments in climate programs, and efforts to support more affordable housing in the country. That from Business Insider. The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg also held a news conference today on his department's budget request.
Our USDOT budget request of $146.2 billion would allow us to continue advancing work on a number of areas, and I'd like to highlight just a few. The budget includes $16.8 billion for the Federal Transit Administration to support urban and rural transit service, including $2.4 billion for major capital projects through the Capital Investment Grant Program, or CIG. For example, it provides $350 million to extend the Red Line in Chicago to the far south side, including the community of Roseland, which stays in my mind because I noticed when we visited there, as residents from that part of South Chicago were describing how long it takes them to get to the Loop, the downtown area where most of the jobs are, that residents of the neighborhood of Roseland in the city limits of Chicago take about an hour and a half to get downtown, which is the same as the community of Roseland, Indiana, which is 90 miles away, if you do have a car. But we're fixing that. And it's estimated that over 13,000 people a day will be boarding the L at these newly created stops and be able to benefit from more of the economic opportunity in their city. So just one example of the life-changing potential of the CIG program that's getting robust funding in this request. The budget also includes vital resources to increase rail safety and to improve passenger rail. That includes $2.5 billion for Amtrak, increasing the number of safety inspectors to a record 400 inspectors, and adding new staff to complete safety audits.
The Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at a news conference in Washington on the president's fiscal year 2025 budget request. New York Times reporting on this, saying President Biden proposed several initiatives in his budget aimed at lowering housing costs at a moment when high interest rates and rapid inflation have made buying and renting more expensive. The proposals include a mix of measures, including tax credits for first-time homebuyers and new incentives intended to encourage the construction and renovation of affordable housing. If enacted by Congress, the budget would invest more than $258 billion to build or preserve over 2 million units, according to the White House. That was reporting from the New York Times. The president spoke about these housing initiatives, part of a larger address to the National League of Cities conference in Washington.
Well, I know the cost of housing is critical to families nationwide. If inflation keeps coming down, mortgage rates are going to continue to come down as well. But I'm not waiting. For those seeking to buy their first home or trade up for a little more space, I propose a tax cut that will provide $400 a month for the next 2 years. Because every family deserves a place to call home and a place to have your American dreams come true. Look, millions of renters are also out there in trouble. We're also cracking down on those landlords who break the antitrust laws by price-fixing those rents. Landlords should be competing to give folks the best deal, not conspiring to charge them higher rent. We also cut red tape so more builders can get federal financing, which is already helping construct a record 1.7 million new housing units nationwide. Because of you. And the federal budget that I'm releasing today has a plan for 2 million more affordable homes, including housing and a housing innovation fund to help communities like yours build housing, renovate housing, and convert empty office space and hotels into housing. Housing for renters, for owners, middle-class families, and folks struggling just to get by. Look, and we realize many of you are dealing with homeless encampments in your cities and towns. Well, we're providing $8 billion to allow you to provide alternatives, to move unhoused people off the street, getting them into homes. The bottom line is you have to build, build, build. That's how we bring housing costs down for good.
President Joe Biden at the National League of Cities Conference in Washington, D.C., just a bit of a speech that covered many topics and many aspects of his proposed fiscal year 2025 budget. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Marsha Fudge, speaking of housing, announced today that she will resign from her position on March 22nd. She's been the head of HUD for 3 years and has spent about 50 years in public service, including as a mayor and a member of Congress. She tells USA Today, "It's time to go home. I do believe strongly that I have done just about everything I could at HUD for this administration as we go into this crazy, silly season of an election." President Biden putting out a statement of thanks and congratulations, and that was followed up by the Deputy White House Press Secretary Olivia Dalton on Air Force One.
I do want to echo the president's deep gratitude and recognition for Secretary of Housing and Urban Development Marsha Fudge, who will be departing the administration later this month. As you will read in the president's statement, no one understands the importance of fair housing market and access to quality and affordable housing better than Secretary Fudge. So I wanted to briefly highlight a few key accomplishments from her tenure. Under her leadership, HUD removed barriers to homeownership, resulting in more than 1.5 million new FHA homeowners and the highest rate of first-time homebuyers in 20 years. At her direction, the department worked closely with partners at the federal, state, and local level to increase the housing supply, particularly the supply of affordable homes, while allocating historic resources to address homelessness. And with Secretary Fudge at the helm, HUD strictly enforced fair housing laws and took a stance against racial bias and discrimination in the appraisal market. We are so grateful for Secretary Fudge for her years of public service as mayor, as a member of Congress, and as a cabinet secretary, and of course, as a trusted advisor to the president. We wish her nothing but the best in her next chapter. And while Secretary Fudge may be leaving the department, this administration's work to lower housing costs and create more affordable housing will continue.
Olivia Dalton is the Deputy White House Press Secretary, starting out her briefing today on Air Force One. This is Washington Today. From Forbes, former President Donald Trump briefly suggested cutting spending on entitlements like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid while speaking to CNBC's Joe Kernan on Monday, a departure from his previous positions in 2016 and 2020 when he vigorously defended the popular programs, though his campaign quickly claimed he's only interested in cutting waste. That was reporting from Forbes. Here's part of the exchange on CNBC.
At least the perception is that there's not a whole lot of difference between what you think we should do with entitlements or non-discretionary spending and what President Biden is proposing. It's almost the third rail of politics. And we've got a $33, $34 trillion total debt built up, and very little we can do in terms of cutting spending. Discretionary is not going to help. Have you changed your outlook on how to handle entitlements, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, Mr. President? It seems like something has to be done, or else we're going to be stuck at 120% of debt to GDP forever.
So first of all, there is a lot you can do in terms of entitlements, in terms of cutting, and in terms of also the theft and the bad management of entitlements, tremendous bad management of entitlements. There's tremendous amounts of things and numbers of things you can do. So I don't, you know, necessarily agree with the statement. I know that they're going to end up weakening Social Security because the country is weak. I mean, you take a look at outside of the stock market, we're going through hell. People are going through hell. They have, and I believe the number is 50%. They say 32 and 33%. I believe we have a cumulative inflation of over 50%. That means people are, you know, they have to make more than 50% more over a fairly short period of time to stay up. They've gotten routed. The middle class in our country has been routed. And the middle class largely built our country. And they have been treated very, very badly with policy. When I was president, I was doing a job. We were going to start to pay off debt. We were drill, baby, drill. We were producing oil, but we were going at a much higher level, oil and gas.
Former President Donald Trump, the expected 2024 Republican presidential nominee, in an interview on CNBC Today, the Biden reelection campaign posted a shortened version on X, stopping at the word cutting, and the president's account adding, "not on my watch." The Trump campaign then posted, "If you losers didn't cut his answer short, you would know President Trump was talking about cutting waste." Well, there's a lot of debate today about federal budget proposals for fiscal year 2025 and beyond, the president releasing his official plan, and the House Republicans had marked up their version in committee late last week. Funding for the current fiscal year, which started October 2023 and runs through September 2024, is not yet completed. We spoke to Bloomberg Government Congress reporter Jack Fitzpatrick.
They've done 6 of the 12 appropriations bills. They have not done the biggest ones or the toughest ones. So the outstanding issues are the Department of Defense, the biggest non-defense bill, which is labor, HHS, and education. And usually, especially this year, the toughest one to resolve is Homeland Security. You've heard plenty of arguments over immigration policy, border security that's played into the foreign aid debate. That makes it very difficult to fund the Department of Homeland Security, so that's an especially difficult one. It also includes state and foreign operations. Funding the Department of State at a time when there's this debate over Ukraine aid, Israel and Palestine, Hamas, that is not an easy one either. So they've got a lot of money at stake, a lot of programs at stake, and they're the bigger, tougher issues left for next Friday.
Leaving the toughest for last, and the clock is ticking. What sort of pressure is Speaker Johnson under here in his negotiations? Is this looking like this might be one of those bills that might get more Democratic support than Republican support if it goes to the House floor?
It certainly could. They got more Democratic support than Republican support in the vote for the first six bills. And again, those were supposed to be the easier ones. Now, one of the pressure points for a speaker is, can you follow the Hastert rule? Can you get a majority of the majority and at least make sure that there are more Republicans voting for it than Republicans voting against it? Because this has to be bipartisan, it has to have the president's support, it has to get through a Democratic-controlled Senate. You're not going to get 218 votes just from Republicans. You are going to need something bipartisan. It is tough for the speaker to envision any circumstance in which he's not relying on a great number of Democratic votes, but if he can at least get a majority of his caucus to support it, that protects him to a pretty significant degree. And he did manage that at least for these first six bills.
Bloomberg Government Congress reporter Jack Fitzpatrick on C-SPAN's Washington Journal program this morning. Find our full segment with him archived at cspan.org. On Wall Street today, the Dow up 46, NASDAQ down 65, S&P down 5. The Wall Street Journal reported this past weekend the Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into the door plug blowout at 16,000 feet on that Boeing 737 MAX 9 jet plane operated by Alaska Airlines. The journal, citing documents it has viewed and anonymous sources, said the investigators have contacted passengers and crew on that flight from January 5th. Today, the Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg and the FAA Administrator Michael Whitaker were asked about that.
We learned recently the DOJ investigation, criminal investigation into Boeing. And then this weekend that Boeing doesn't appear to have records around removing a door panel during manufacturing. It raises again a question: if you can't trust Boeing to install bolts or document that they installed the bolts, how do you trust that they're building anything safe?
I'll toss to Mike in a moment to share more from the FAA perspective. Obviously, we respect the independence of DOJ and NTSB doing their own work, but we're not neutral on the question of whether Boeing should fully cooperate with any entity, NTSB, us, or DOJ, and they should, and we expect them to. I would also say the administrator's leadership has been really critical to making clear to Boeing that they need to go through a serious transformation here in terms of their responsiveness, their culture, and their quality issues. But with that, let me turn it over to the administrator to share a little more about how he's approaching this.
Thank you. I guess I would just add, as you know, we've increased our audit and our oversight of Boeing pretty significantly since January 5th. If we see something that requires us to cease production or pull something down, we'll do that. But we're continuing that oversight, and we're working with Boeing and demanding that they come up with a very detailed plan within the next 90 days to fix the quality issues that are out there. And while that work is going on, we will continue to increase our oversight to make sure the planes that are getting their airworthiness certificates are safe airplanes.
Is not having the paperwork on we took a door off and put it back on not enough of a red flag to take additional action? And that seems like a fairly glaring mess up.
Right, and that's part of the NTSB investigation. As part of our investigation, we've issued a letter of investigation over the incident. It is one of the factors that we're considering as we formulate a plan to get the quality assurance where it needs to be. There should be paperwork for that.
Federal Aviation Administration Administrator Michael Whitaker and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg at a news conference in Washington. The National Transportation Safety Board, NTSB, has concluded that bolts on the door plug likely were not reinstalled after being removed for repair at the Boeing plant in Renton, Washington. Alaska Airlines putting out a statement: in an event like this, it's normal for the Justice Department to be conducting an investigation. We are fully cooperating and do not believe we are a target of the investigation. Washington Today continues in a moment.
Hi, it's Nate from C-SPAN. Imagine, 45 years ago when there were just a handful of television networks, C-SPAN first went on the air, bringing an unfiltered view of government directly to America's living rooms. No spin, no commentary, just pure democracy in action.
And it's Shannon from C-SPAN. It was a bold experiment. We finally had a front row seat to Congress, the White House, and the campaign trail, all without government funding.
As we celebrate 45 years and a legacy of unfiltered access, we ask for your support of a donation in honor of over four decades of service. Your gift, no matter how big or small, will help maintain this vital resource for access to the democratic process.
You can help ensure another 45 years of witnessing history unfold and empowering citizens to be informed and engaged in the political process. Visit cspan.org/donate today and join our 45th anniversary campaign.
Thank you for supporting C-SPAN, your unfiltered view of government. Visit cspan.org/donate today to make your gift of support. Thank you.
Welcome back to Washington Today, available as a podcast on the free C-SPAN Now mobile app and wherever you find your podcasts. Story from the New York Times, House Republican leaders are pushing forward this week with a planned vote on legislation that would force the Chinese owners of TikTok to divest or face being barred in the United States, even after former President Donald J. Trump reversed course and declared himself staunchly opposed to targeting the popular social media app he once vowed to ban. Representative Steve Scalise, Republican of Louisiana and the majority leader, said on Monday that the House would try to speed the bill to passage under special procedures reserved for non-controversial legislation, which requires a two-thirds majority for passage. The approach reflected the bill's growing momentum on Capitol Hill during an election year in which members of both political parties are eager to demonstrate a willingness to be tough on China. That was from the New York Times. Today, at a Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, the ranking Republican, the vice chair, Marco Rubio of Florida, asked FBI Director Christopher Wray about this House bill.
I talked about TikTok in the opening. Just to lay the groundwork here, TikTok is this American, TikTok U.S. American company or headquartered putatively in America. And they have this platform, which is fascinating, right? And people, it's very effective, very good, has a lot of members. One of the things that powers it is that it is powered by an algorithm based on artificial intelligence, where the more you use it, the more it learns about you. It, in essence, reads your mind. It knows the kinds of videos you like, and it feeds you more and more of them, causing you to go back. That algorithm is not owned by TikTok. It's owned by ByteDance, a Chinese company, correct?
That's my understanding.
And so the only way that algorithm works is if that Chinese company has access to the data being generated by TikTok. The owner of the algorithm, ByteDance, has to have access. So it doesn't matter where the data is stored. Ultimately, they have to have access to it in order to make the algorithm work. Correct?
Right. I mean, I think what you're getting to is the key point is that the parent company is, for all intents and purposes, beholden to the CCP.
Well, the reason why I raise that is if ByteDance in China is the one that owns the driver that makes TikTok effective, isn't it true that under Chinese law, the Chinese Communist Party says that data that you're gaining access to in order to make your algorithm work, we want a copy of that data? If they said that to ByteDance in the future, ByteDance would have to give it to them.
That's my understanding.
And if they went to them and said, we want you to change your algorithm so that Americans start seeing videos that hurt this candidate or help that candidate in the upcoming election, ByteDance would have to do that under Chinese law.
That's my understanding.
And if they said, we want you to put out videos that make Americans fight with each other or spread conspiracy theories and get them at each other's throat, ByteDance can't go to Chinese court and fight the Communist Party. They would have to do it.
That's my understanding. And I would just add that that kind of influence operation or the different kinds of influence operations you're describing are extraordinarily difficult to detect, which is part of what makes the national security concerns represented by TikTok so significant.
All right, thank you.
Senator Marco Rubio, Republican from Florida, vice chair of the Intelligence Committee, questioning the FBI Director Christopher Wray. And the U.S. House plans to debate the bill Tuesday to require ByteDance divest itself of TikTok or face a ban of TikTok in U.S. app stores. Tuesday afternoon, the bill is H.R. 7521, titled Protecting Americans from Foreign Adversary-Controlled Applications Act. We will, of course, have live debate on C-SPAN television and on the C-SPAN Now mobile app, gavel to gavel. Story from CNN, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban has said Donald Trump would effectively end the war in Ukraine by cutting off funding to Kyiv should the former president return to power in November. Orban said in an interview to Hungarian broadcaster M1 Broadcast on Sunday, Donald Trump has a very clear vision. He says the following: first, he will not give a single penny for the Russo-Ukrainian war. That's why the war will end, because it's obvious that Ukraine cannot stand on its own two feet. The CNN article says Orban's comments came after Trump hosted the Hungarian strongman at Mar-a-Lago on Friday. Today, at that Senate Intelligence Committee hearing, the CIA director William Burns gave his assessment of the future of the war in Ukraine.
I just returned from my 10th visit to Ukraine during the course of the war, and I left convinced that we're at a profoundly important crossroads for Ukraine, for European security, and for long-term American interests around the world. I think down one road with supplemental assistance approved by the Congress lies the very real possibility of cementing a strategic success for Ukraine and a strategic loss for Vladimir Putin's Russia. It's our assessment that with supplemental assistance, Ukraine can hold its own on the front lines through 2024 and into early 2025, Ukraine can continue to exact costs against Russia, not only with deep penetration strikes in Crimea, but also against Russia's Black Sea Fleet, continuing the success which has resulted in 15 Russian ships sunk over the course of the last 6 months. In other words, with supplemental assistance, Ukraine can put itself in a position by the end of 2024, the beginning of 2025, where it could regain the offensive initiative and also put itself in a position to negotiate from a position of greater strength and achieve an outcome in which Putin's goal, which was to subjugate Ukraine and to control its choices, would be denied, where Ukraine could sustain itself as a strong, sovereign, independent country, anchor itself in Western institutions, and have the space and the security to recover from this terrible aggression, and leave Russia to deal with the long-term consequences of Putin's brutal and foolish invasion. Down another road, however, without supplemental assistance, it seems to me, lies a much grimmer future. Ukraine is likely to lose ground and probably significant ground in 2024. I saw, in the Battle of Avdiivka, which forced a rushed withdrawal of Ukrainian forces just a couple of days before I was in Kyiv on this last visit, the consequences of that. One senior Ukrainian partner described what happened to me. He said that, our men fought as long and as hard as they could. We ran out of ammunition, and the Russians just kept coming. And I think without supplemental assistance in 2024, you're going to see more of Avdiivkas. And that, it seems to me, would be a massive and historic mistake for the United States.
CIA Director William Burns testifying before the Senate Intelligence Committee. From BBC News, President Volodymyr Zelensky has hailed Ukraine's first ever Oscar won by 20 Days in Mariupol, a documentary about Russia's brutal siege of the port city. The film shows the truth about Russian terrorism, Mr. Zelensky said. Some headlines from the war between Israel and Hamas from NBC News. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan has begun in much of the world with no sign of the ceasefire the U.S. has been pushing for. Mounting fears of a famine in the Gaza Strip and concerns that tensions could erupt around holy sites in Jerusalem. A U.S. Army vessel carrying equipment to build a pier off the Palestinian enclave's coast has left for the Mediterranean, but the first ship carrying 200 tons of food aid remains docked in Cyprus after delays. Aid agencies have criticized the plan for a maritime humanitarian corridor, saying it falls far short of meeting the needs of Gaza's population of 2.2 million. And Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has defended his policies after President Joe Biden said in an interview on MSNBC that he was hurting Israel more than helping. Netanyahu also vowed to move ahead with plans for a military offensive in Rafah, the southern city, where some 1.5 million Palestinians are sheltering. That was from NBC News. Reporters asked the White House Deputy Press Secretary Olivia Dalton aboard Air Force One about President Biden and Prime Minister Netanyahu's views on how that war is going.
You said the other day that going into Rafah would be a red line. And then I believe the Prime Minister said, well, we're doing that anyway. What are his thoughts about the Prime Minister obviously not caring that much about what the President said?
Look, the president was clear this weekend in his view that Israel has a right to self-defense, to protect itself in the face of an existential threat that's posed by Hamas. He's also said that he believes Israel needs to do that in a manner consistent with the laws of war and pay greater attention to the level of humanitarian suffering and the unacceptably high level of civilian casualties that we're seeing. The president has also, I think, iterated in that interview that our view is that no military operation should take place in Rafah if there is not a credible and implementable plan to take care of the safety and security needs of the more than a million civilians who are sheltering there. And we've seen no such plan. So the president was very clear in his remarks. I don't think it is productive for me to add speculation there one way or the other. I think he has been very clear about what our overall position is, and we're not going to get into sort of hypotheticals or back and forth.
Does the red line mean anything? The things about protecting civilian life and et cetera, the president's been saying that since, like, days after October 7th. So what does a red line mean differently than what he's been saying?
I don't think that it's productive to assign a red line sort of terminology to what is a very complex set of policies. So I'm just going to leave it there. I think the president was very clear about what his overall approach and view of this situation is and what needs to happen.
Olivia Dalton, the White House Deputy Press Secretary, speaking to reporters on Air Force One. Prominent progressive organizations in the United States, writes Al Jazeera, are joining together to push back against the political and electoral influence of the country's most powerful pro-Israel lobby group, the American Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. More than 20 advocacy groups launched on Monday a formal coalition dubbed Reject AIPAC to organize against what they called AIPAC's campaign to silence the growing dissent in Congress against Israel's war on Gaza. From Reuters, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken headed to Jamaica on Monday to attend a Caribbean Community or CARICOM meeting on Haiti, where a collapse in security and a humanitarian crisis in the Caribbean nation has unfolded, the State Department said. Blinken departed from Washington on Monday morning on a trip organized at the last minute as spiraling gang violence threatens to bring down Haiti's government. On Sunday, the U.S. military airlifted non-essential personnel and stepped up security at Washington's embassy in Port-au-Prince. That was from Reuters. More on this from the State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at his briefing in Washington.
So the secretary is in Kingston, Jamaica today to attend the CARICOM high-level meeting on Haiti to advance a compromise on the ongoing political stalemate threatening the country's citizens and security. The proposal that is on the table that CARICOM has developed over the past several days in consultation with Haitian stakeholders and consultation with the United States would expedite a political transition through the creation of a broad-based independent presidential college to steer the country toward the deployment of a multinational security support mission and free and fair elections. And that's what I expect the secretary will be discussing with his colleagues.
Prime Minister Henri have any presence there virtually or
other? I am not aware of any, but as always, I will defer to him to speak to his travels.
And is it your understanding he's still in Puerto Rico?
Again, I'm going to defer to him to speak to his travels.
Can you tell us any more about the decision to evacuate some embassy personnel?
So as you may aware, we have been on order departure status since last July, where we have ordered a certain number of embassy personnel to leave. Since we went to that status last July, there have been embassy personnel that have left at different times, and at times we have moved additional personnel in. So we had a number of embassy personnel that left over the weekend. We had additional security forces that deployed to the mission because of the security situation there, and we'll continue to assess the situation and make whatever appropriate decisions we need to protect our staff and personnel there.
Can you say anything further about any American passport holders in Haiti, if there's any American citizens reaching out to the embassy, hoping for assistance, given the precariousness of flights in and out of Haiti and things that are developing quickly?
So we are in contact with a number of American citizens in Haiti. I do want to reiterate that we have had a level 4 travel alert for Haiti for more than 4 years now, making very clear to American citizens that, number one, they should not travel to Haiti, that it is not safe to travel to Haiti, and number two, that they are, if they are in Haiti, they should leave as soon as it's safe for them to do so. Now, obviously, that's a warning that has been in place for 4 years. It's not safe for a number of them to leave right now, and they're not able to leave right now because the airport has been damaged and commercial carriers have suspended flights. So what we are asking U.S. citizens to do today is to register through our crisis intake form, which you can get to through the embassy's website, and we will communicate with them the best information we have when we have it.
The State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller at his news conference in Washington. He also said the U.S. is looking to expedite the deployment of that United Nations-backed multinational security support mission to Haiti, which will be led by Kenya. A headline at space.com, NASA Chief Bill Nelson promises a fight for the agency's 2025 budget request. The article says that the administrator says his agency was caught in a congressional compromise for spending cuts in fiscal year 2025, and he argued that NASA has bipartisan support, but like other government departments, received funding cuts in fiscal year 2024 and 25 because, quote, a small group in the House of Representatives held up the budget process. The administrator delivered his State of NASA address and talked about the budget proposal, fiscal year 2025, released today by the president, and saying the priorities were earth science, climate research, and a return to the moon.
So today, the administration announced the president's request for NASA for fiscal year 25. And that budget is $25.4 billion. That's an increase of $500 million over the previous fiscal year, 24. In addition, that figure, if enacted, and it's a request to the Congress, if enacted, it would amount to more than a 9% increase in NASA appropriations since President Biden took office when he asked Pam and me to lead this agency. Of all the deals that we could have gotten during the 2 years of the cap budgets, this is a good one. NASA fared better than other agencies and departments that are in that appropriations subcommittee report. It's a result of our advocates in the White House, in Congress, and right here in this building, pushing to get us the resources that we need to reach for the stars. I thank the president for his committed leadership to support NASA. I thank our friends in Congress who are committed to help us. And come fiscal year 26, which is not too far away, it's October of next year, you can expect that we're going to push for more resources. Why? Because our great work goes on using the resources that Congress gives us. Our work to return humanity to the moon and then reach onward to the red sands of Mars, that goes on. Our work to build from the ground up, hundreds of miles up, an economy and presence in low Earth orbit, that work goes on. Our work to transform the way we fly, leaner, cleaner, quieter, faster, that work goes on.
The NASA Administrator Bill Nelson, a former U.S. Senator, Democrat from Florida, in his annual State of NASA address at NASA headquarters in Washington. Thanks for listening to Washington Today. Subscribe to C-SPAN's free evening newsletter, Word for Word, and you'll get the stories making headlines in Washington sent to your inbox each day. Sign up at cspan.org/connect. Have a good night.